that's exactly against why the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was made. And it came out of a splitting of identities and a hierarchy of identities. So that's where I'm afraid things are moving. But I am actually very optimistic because the world is changing, because we're no longer allowing spaces where abuse, misogyny, systemic racism is allowed. And those old systems of power are breaking down, new ones are rising. And that's why we're getting the backlash. So I'm hopeful that things are changing actually for the good. But I think it's really important to be aware of where things look a bit, you know, worrying.
Rambling on, rambling on, rambling on.
Hello and welcome back. We hope you had a really lovely Hanukkah. I am Rabbi Miriam Berger, joined as always with my wonderful colleagues, Rabbi Robin Ashworthstein and Rabbi Debbie Young-Summers. Debbie, I have to enjoy the irony of just days after our ranty Hanukkah podcast about Christmas and Hanukkah differences of practice. I love the fact that you were hobnobbing with royalty at Westminster Abbey at our Royals Carol service. Did you enjoy it?
It was absolutely gorgeous. So I often go to the Commonwealth service at Westminster Abbey, where there's a kind of gang of leaders from different faith communities who come each year and process down the aisle and recess at the end. And every other year we get to read a prayer. And we haven't done, the last time actually that I was at the Abbey was for that service in March 2020, really sort of a week or two before lockdown. It must have been 2 or 3 weeks before lockdown. And, you know, we were there with lots of people not socially distancing and not masking. And this was a very different experience. There was no procession for us faith leaders. We were just sort of sent to our front row seats, and everyone was masked up. And but it was absolutely glorious to hear the choir. And of course, wearing a mask meant that if I wanted to sing along a little bit with the beautiful carols, I could. Very sort of remembering school days and the carol concerts of my youth. But it was a really beautiful occasion. The whole point of the service, which was done sort of by invitation of the Duchess of Cambridge, it was sort of her baby.
Look at that name drop.
But it was to celebrate all the contributions that communities and individuals and organisations have made over the last 2 years to help support each other and get us through the pandemic. And, you know, there were beautiful moments of these different people lighting candles and reading contributions. Lem Sisse, who's a poet, read a beautiful composition about, you know, last year we were apart and this year we're going to just drown each other in love and hugs. And I suppose that, you know, that sense of, I really hope we're going to be able to do that. It's all kind of hanging a little bit on edge. Let's see what happens. But yes, very lovely to be able to represent Reformed Judaism at Westminster Abbey and celebrate all that all of our communities have done to support one another and look after each other. And hopefully we will continue to do that.
Did you manage to take some of those very cool electric candles that you were all given to make next year's Hanukkah? I would have definitely been snaffling nine.
We arrived at our seats and had these lovely electric candles on our chairs. Miriam was messaging me asking if we'd got a freebie at all. What's the going home gift? Unfortunately, I tried to turn the candle on myself and nothing happened. I was like, what's going on with this candle? It's an electronic candle. They are all mass controlled somewhere in the Abbey. Ooh, and they turn on when the Abbey wants them on. So there was really no point in taking one, let alone nine of them home. Plus, I had a very small handbag and they were each kind of pillar candles. I would have really struggled to smuggle one out.
Although now I'm thinking that we need them for FRS. I was just about to say. Lots of reasons for needing those.
I know. I can see that soon in an FRS newsletter.
I'm going to be on the phone to Westminster Abbey tonight to find out what they are and how you use them. Sounds fantastic. Anyway, do you think we need to be talking about other things as well as carol concerts? We're into the swing of all that is darkness and finding light and this time of year. And we're really drawn to this topic of human rights. So just before we really get the conversation underway, I'd love to know what comes to mind when you think of this phrase, human rights. Robin?
Oh, I mean, we could go so many different ways, couldn't we, with this? I think one way, just because I'm sat at the moment in our synagogue, a Manchester Reform synagogue, just one thing that is a, and we'll probably unpack this more, a moment for me of what it is to be in community when we're talking about human rights. So I came into Shul one Shabbat, this was a couple of years ago now, and there's a police cordon at the end of the road. If people don't know, Manchester Reform Synagogue's right in the city centre. It's, you know, unusually right in the heart of the city. And there's a police cordon. I came in and I was, you know, what's happened? We're often cordoned off for events or whatever. But a man who was rough sleeping had passed away that evening on Friday night at the end of our road. And I was, and to this day, I find it absolutely shocking that that can happen. And that kind of, it felt almost like a question to the community in a sense. Like, you're here, what does it mean that that happens on your doorstep? And there was a midrash that I studied when I was at college in Pesikta de Rav Kahana, which talks about Rabbi Joshua Levy. And we went to Rome and he saw marble pillars which had been carefully covered with wrapping to keep them from cracking during the heat. So they were all wrapped and looked after and attended to. And he also saw a man in need who had just a reed mat, nothing to protect him, sleeping rough in front of this thing. And that midrash was like brought to life. It's like this huge building we have that we invest in, and someone dies at the end of the road because they're not looked after. So for me, that was like a challenge, a question to the community. But maybe we can unpack it a bit more. But that's the one thing that came to mind when you asked.
Extraordinary. What an image. Just devastating.
This doesn't answer that question, but your story, Robin, reminded me of when I was a teenager celebrating Purim at Radlett Reform. Our rabbi, Alex Wright at the time, her costume for Purim was to essentially dress up in disguise as someone who was homeless and sit on the steps of the synagogue and then tell us how we had reacted. We couldn't tell that it was her on the way in. There was just this sort of homeless space in front of the synagogue.
Oh my gosh.
And her response of kind of how people had ignored her, how people had stepped over her. It was really eye-opening and powerful, especially on a festival like Purim when usually we're a little bit giddy. And yeah, it was a really, really impactful Purim marker that I've never forgotten.
Yeah, well, that's the humanity piece. That's the human rights, isn't it? It's when people are dehumanized, when you allow people to pass away on your street or die out of neglect, and also when we just ignore the person. That's a really amazing, shocking story. Wow.
There's something for me in the phrase human rights that actually almost does the opposite to that which we're intending it to do, which is kind of others people, that we talk about them as a collective, as a group, whether they're homeless or whether they're refugees, whether they are being kind of hurt at the expense of a dictatorship, or whether we're discussing whether, you know, the LGBTQ community should be allowed to get married or whether women should be able to have an abortion. There's something in that thing of we sort of make it about other people and it's not about ourselves. And there's something about how do we look at human rights just as us all being just mankind. You know, we are all just people who are able to live, and what do we need? What do we deserve? What should our rights be in terms of simply being safe, able to be the people we are, and not have to conform in certain ways to somebody else's establishment of, you know, what makes humans a human?
Although one of the challenges of that personalization stuff and othering is that I think one of the trends I see quite often in the Jewish community is we get really good at moving ourselves on issues that have affected us historically or that we feel are our story. When, you know, so stories around genocide, stories around refugees, and actually it may not be directly my story, and we then miss the humanity of other stories as well because we're so focused on those stories that speak to us. But I guess that's how we work as humans, right? We focus on that which ties to our story and that meets our interest too.
Robin, I'd absolutely love your help on this because Each year on December the 10th, we mark International Human Rights Day, which is the anniversary of the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the United Nations. And I can say that, and I can ensure that there are pieces woven into our services this Shabbat, which ensure that we are kind of connecting with that concept. And many of our communities are engaged with an array of work in support of human rights. And, you know, our youth movement, RSY Netzer, joined with human rights charity Rene Cassin. 23 of our communities across the country on Mitzvah Day last month gathered donations for food banks. Like, it's what we do as part of the reform movement. And yet, very few of us have the understanding that you have. As a former human rights lawyer that went into the rabbinate, you know, what does it mean to you? What are the values that kind of took you first of all into that legal side and then took you into the rabbinate? You know, for me, my first image of you will always be you walking into my office with your very large briefcase of, you know, legal notes that you'd been working on a case to come and talk to me about the rabbinate. And in some ways, those two careers feel so distant from each other. And in other ways, they feel so connected. Teach us, you know, tell us about human rights and kind of how you see it fitting together.
Yeah, I remember that evening so well. I was on a case in South London and trawled all the way with this massive, as a junior solicitor would, with all of the case load into your office at Finchley. Well, so for me, I wanted to be a rabbi from the age of 11. That was always what I wanted to do. It was very clear. So I did theology at uni for that end. When I came out of university, I felt too young. I know lots of people do train to be rabbis early on and are here now. But for me, I just thought I needed more. Like I wasn't ready in lots of different ways, partly because my Judaism didn't translate to being at uni. It was very Manchester based. And look, I'm now back in Manchester being a rabbi. But anyway, I couldn't work it out. So I was actually just chatting to my mum and she just said, well, have you thought about human rights law? I was like, great, sounds brilliant, exactly what I should be doing. I've always had a really strong social justice kind of, you know, understanding of myself and how to be in the world and my Judaism. So I went and trained to be a human rights lawyer specifically and then worked in Manchester and then in London doing that. And then eventually got back into wanting to be a rabbi, partly because I felt frustrated in what I was doing in law and wanted to do more and realize the power of communities in that, which maybe we can touch upon. But I think for me, maybe a vignette of this is I was in a hotel on holiday. We went traveling and I was watching a film, Hotel Rwanda, which is just devastating. And I was weeping at the end of it. And I was weeping because of the film, but I was also weeping because I'd been I was training as a lawyer. When I was training, I helped on a case of a Rwandan genocidaire who was accused of committing genocide crimes in Rwanda. And we were representing him to protect his human rights in the unfair trial that he would go through and the processes of extradition from the UK to Rwanda and what, you know, how his human rights, his right to family and all of this stuff would be upended. And I remember in that hotel room, this was a couple of years after the case, really just sitting with my particular Jewish story of genocide and this. For me, that interchange of what human rights is and working on it is all about courage and it's all about integrity. And it's all about having strong key principles, which are like just demanded of us throughout the Torah. Like for me, that is my Judaism. I don't see anything else but demands on me to build a better world for others and myself. But that was a real moment of, that's what it takes. That's what human rights is about. It's about having these fundamental principles that you cannot drop, because as soon as you do, then the systems of power and, you know, misabuse and abuse happens, that those are key. Anyway, that was one moment that really will always stay with me, because it was a real moment of looking deeply within.
Extraordinary.
How does your sort of background in human rights impact what you do today? Do you feel able to continue that in your rabbinate, or is it something that you've sort of happily set aside?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And I'm always trying to integrate all of this together. One of the reasons that I left human rights law is, one, because I've always wanted to be a rabbi, like it's my vocation, it's just in my deep being. But it's also because the kind of law that I was in, amazing. If you get high up in it, and you can have real impact on the way the world is in society. But where I was working and what I was doing, it was very frustrating because you could only help an individual in a very certain way. And legal aid was very bad at that time. And often someone who is mistreated, I went into public law and asylum law, the asylum system is broken. So it would take years for people's cases to get through. And I wasn't able to help them with the bigger picture. I could only help them on their case. I was only paid to do so much. And I did public law, so where people were, one example in immigration detention, a mum and her daughter really badly mistreated. And we got them success in the case, which meant they got a settlement of a few thousand pounds. No apology, no change in the system, no culture shift. And I found it so frustrating. And I turned back to community in the rabbinate because I really believe that that is where change, seismic, transformational, cultural shifts can happen. So I really like, I know that being in Manchester and being like having the privilege of being the rabbi in Manchester and being in the city centre, and I've seen it, you know, the communities you work in and the work you've both done, is that when you have the relational power of a whole community together with the teachings that we have, like driving us forward from the beginning of time almost, like our ancient teachings care about the way we are and justice in the world, all of that means that for me, being a community rabbi enables much more fully my understanding of what it is to protect human rights and to be in it. And of course, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was founded and came to life because of the Holocaust. It was the response to it, which is why the Human Rights Act we have in Britain is so important. We enact that within our legislation, and the threats against that are terrifying for what that represents, because universal, that's how tightly this is all together. Like our Jewish story, that's why we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That was the response to it. So for me, it's all tied up together. And this is my commitment, really, hopefully, to the work of justice together.
It's fascinating when that kind of, when what you're given is the structure to ensure that almost the emotional response is never the thing that's the forefront. That actually what we're given are those guiding principles that mean you can't do. I was reading an amazing piece by a doctor describing the Westminster Bridge terror attack and arriving on the scene where there are two patients, essentially the policeman who had been brutally attacked and the attacker, the terrorist who had been shot. And that kind of role as a doctor, that actually in that moment, your role is to heal and to save lives. And you're not at that point judge and jury. You know, you step back from asking any questions as to why these people are lying here hurt. And your job is to heal. And that piece where these ideas of human rights weave through what becomes people's day to day, you know, the fact that you don't choose who your clients are. Mm-hmm. You offer them you offer them justice, and it's for others to then see, well, what is justice in this instance?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's why, I mean, the rule of law is crucial to that, because that's the structure. That's why structures are so important. And within communities, why we need to make sure we have really proper process and we have, you know, safeguarding and all of this, because the law is a system where justice can be enacted. It's not always like that. Like having worked in law, it doesn't always feel like justice is got, which can be really painful in lots of ways. Especially, we had loads of, our firm used to specialize in deaths in custody, which obviously a lot of black men were subject to mistreatment, neglect, violence by certain police officers. And they were involved in the Stephen Lawrence inquiry when that happened. And seeing that kind of thing within the law that is meant to establish and uphold justice can be really difficult. So those concepts of justice and law and what those look like, complex as well. But that commitment, and you know, we're a legal people, the Jewish people, we care intimately about what we do and how we do it. And another aspect for me, being a community rabbi in this, and it kind of follows on from what you were saying and what Debbie was saying, is that there's also something, and Brené Brown puts it really nicely, about the micro and the macro that you can do in Jewish communities. So I really care, like for me, Judaism is political and spirituality is political. It's not separate. So when I'm in a service and we're talking about the importance of rest, for example, and Shabbat and ceasing from work and everything, That is to enable me to go out into the world to do the work. So for me, all of this is together. And in the legal world, I found very little space for all of that and the spirituality and Judaism part of it. Whereas I'm really interested in how can I be a reflective, grounded, spiritual, Jewishly influenced and person so that I can go out into the world and do the work that's demanded of me as a Jew and as a human as well.
I think one of the challenges is trying to work out where we can best put our energy, because there are so many areas that need fixing, that need our help, that need our support, that we could use our voice on. But yet we're also juggling, you know, life cycle and funerals and services and lessons and everything else that rabbis do. How do you each actually prioritize what you're going to focus your energy on?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm very firmly in the tradition of community organizing, which was started by a Jew in Solilinsky in America and taught by, you know, particularly to our Jewish community by Charlotte Fisher, who's a community organizer. And we're part of a community organizing body here in Manchester. And I'm the co-chair of our local chapter. And that is all about listening for stories. So we did a listening exercise here at Jackson's Row at Manchester Reform Synagogue, listening to people to say what, you know, what pain is there for being in a citizen of Greater Manchester? I think that was a question we asked. And what came out in our community were stories of mental health and not being supported by the authorities or people that were meant to help. And it was very clear that that's where we should start, because that's where we were being affected. And of course, it's a universal thing. It's not just a Jewish problem. None of these things are. And that's the irony. And like Miriam was saying, you know, that them and us stuff, when we think, you know, well, homelessness is over there. We have members of our community who have been homeless and have those stories of, you know, poverty. You name it, we have it in the Jewish community. So for me, it starts with listening. And that self-interest of where are we? So if I know I've heard a story from a congregant about how, you know, they've been let down by the mental health system, I'm then completely invested in it as well. You know, I care about it. And that's where we start. And then you start with something that you know you can be effective in, that where there's going to be a win. So it's not about the massive big picture. It's like, okay, well, what could we transform? You know, waiting times or whatever it is, you start there. Yeah.
I think.
How about you, Miriam?
Yeah, I think for me, it's very similar in terms of we're part of London Citizens, which really helps us kind of facilitate a lot of that piece that means that we can feel part of a bigger, stronger voice because there's more of us. But I think the piece that really drives me and the piece that I can see gives me the passion to inspire the community and to bring them with me and is when we're talking when we're able to personalize the story. So when it's not the news item about Afghan refugees or people in hiding, but actually it's a relative, you know, a member of our team, somebody we know, and therefore are given the absolute voice of the person there in Afghanistan. Like suddenly you can be talking about hundreds of thousands of people in any given story. And when it's one person that you say, oh, now I understand the bigger voice, just from that one story, it for me, it really changes the narrative. And maybe it shouldn't, right? Maybe that's actually not the moral way, but it's the very human way. You know, maybe I should be guided by the, do you know how many millions or how many thousands of people you could be? But that doesn't seem to be the nudge. The nudge seems to be the individual story. And actually, we're all conditioned to feel like that. You know, the number of people we've seen in the last 18 months, when any conversations around COVID, the person who can be saying, I should have the freedom not to need to be vaccinated, until they witness a death, until it's the death of their loved one, until it's them who's lying in a hospital bed, and then they say, I wish I was vaccinated, or I wish they'd been vaccinated. You know, we're all conditioned to understand the individual story. But I think as rabbi, it's kind of my job to bring those individual stories into the heart of my community to magnify the single voice and to therefore kind of bring others along with us in help of that change. Would you say that was the same for you, Debbie?
Yeah, I think it's very similar. And that sense of, you know, what are the voices that call out to us are the things that we can really find the strength to act on. I also think for me, there are certain issues that you know, might be closer to home than others. I think I often end up with my sort of bottom line being about climate change, which doesn't initially sound like a human rights issue, but very much is, and is going to be the root of so many more human rights issues going forward as resources become scarcer, the movement of people away from uninhabitable lands. You know, people are already dying. And actually that sense of, you know, we all feel so helpless, as we do with so many human rights issues, but actually it's everyone making changes that are achievable that will head off a lot of these human rights issues that we're facing. And I think we often forget that climate change is also a human rights issue. So for me, that's kind of one of the big ones that I often start from.
Hmm. Robin, were you ever the Jew in the, you know, in the legal firm? In that, like, I know that that sounds funny, but I wonder, you know, it's easy almost for us to be the rabbis and to be able to say it's our job to highlight these human rights violations and to be the leaders in those moments. But I'm thinking about our listeners, our members of our communities, and how much they see this as their work when they're then in their workplace. So, you know, the pride I have when members tell me about what it means to be, you know, an A&E doctor who's working to change the way that the NHS respond to issues around climate change and put in their work in that sense. Like, how are people, the kind of the Jew filled with their moral compass and the ethics that their Judaism gives them in their place of work, which might seem totally, you know, out of context? You know, how do we encourage our employers to be the employers that pay the London living wage? Or how do we make sure that they're not just Jewish when they walk into our building, I guess is the question I'm asking. And did you manage to be that person and see yourself as that person in the office?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And I think that is part of my frustration of having been a human rights lawyer. So it's this point of integration as well. So when I worked in human rights firms, they're often spaces where religion has, there's no space for religion. And actually it's a very anti-religion, religious space, militantly atheist. So when I did talk about being Jewish, it wasn't really understood. And I remember I asked one person.
Can I just clarify? Is that because religion in general is seen as so often the reason for human rights violations? Yeah. People do it in the name of religion. Yeah. So it became a negative in that space.
Oh, definitely. And also like irrational, patriarchal, you know, everything that human rights isn't, it's understood as being the opposite to it. Parochial, backward, non-political, non-social justice orientated, but of course that's not our understanding or like experience of it at all. I remember I once said, you know, can I leave early on a Friday, and they were said, yeah, absolutely. I said, oh great, because I need to get to synagogue in time. They said, oh, if you told us that, we probably would have said no, and they laughed. I mean, it was really not a space where Judaism was, and I constantly felt that part of my fight for human rights was within the office space. Actually, I remember having to like stick up for me and a Muslim colleague in terms of how we expressed our religion and how it wasn't held, and how it's like complicated because we're in this space, in the human rights space. Why wasn't this respected? And I made points to them that over time, their understanding of religion was so fundamentalist that actually they were more of a fundamentalist than I ever was in my religion. I didn't win, because at the end of before I left, you know, someone said to me, well, look, we get it, but you're the exception to the rule. And I was like, no, I'm not the exception. So many people out there have a deep spiritual religious life that informs, guides, and enables us to do this work and demands it of us. So I felt that really frustrating moment. And being taught by Rabbi Sheila Shulman, Zichrona Livracha, she was so clear that, you know, Judaism, politics and spirituality are one and the same. Like, it's all together. And that was not understood in that space, which is really interesting. And sometimes those very left-wing human rights spaces can be very tricky in terms of bringing that in. But I'm sure there was some shift, you know, in the conversations I had. And I certainly never you know, hid being Jewish, and I brought it into everything. But there's that sense of being other, isn't there? Especially eating matzah at Pesach. That's the one the one moment where you like you can't hide and you're out and you have to explain what you're doing, and you're like, this is because I'm in the story of liberation. I'm literally eating the food of oppression. That's what I'm doing. So like it all links back to human rights, doesn't it? And you can make it, you know, all of it is a big circle, really.
But the crumbs in the office are not fun for anyone.
No,
it's funny that Pesach link is always really fascinating. Every year it seems that there's a new symbol added to the Seder plate for another human rights issue. And I do think it's a really powerful way that we can give voice to things and help us show that this 3,000-year-old tradition is still speaking to us meaningfully through how we engage with it today.
Yeah.
And do you think it's changed over time, sort of the phrase human rights, how we look at this issue? Have you seen a shift? That, you know, I'm really conscious that I often feel it's thrown back at us these days of like, you know, it's my human right to be the person who isn't worried about other people. You know, it gives you the kind of the ability to be deeply selfish, which clearly was not where it came from and where it started. And I wonder if that's just a nuance that we see or we're tuned into, or whether that has shifted.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I really hear what you're saying. People are like, my human rights are being violated, and it's used in a more general sense. I mean, my fear around all of this is that the misunderstanding of human rights has got us to a place where the government, I mean, it's been on the back burner, I think, recently, have wanted the British Bill of Rights. They are actually going, we're going away from an understanding that we are human and universally connected. Like, we can connect with people's experiences. And yes, we have particular stories and particularities, but we're all one, to a much more divided, siloed community where we talk about our own British rights and not those of human rights that connect us to other people. And I see that as a kind of splitting. And I also think that the world's going through a really interesting moment, which is in the way that I was kind of challenged with the Rwandan genocide thing, we're being challenged to say, what does it actually mean if we're committed to human rights? It means we respect what people say. And I think we're seeing this around transgender issues that are coming up. Everyone is feeling so threatened and terrified about these things because they're being challenged to actually put into action the principles we stand by of what it is to confront transphobia, homophobia within us, and what it would mean to actually commit to issues of human rights, to allow people to have dignity, a right to private and to family lives. And we're going through a moment of seismic shift where I think we're being challenged more about what human rights are and what they can be. But I'm really terrified about the splitting and seeing the person, you know, that the individual identities supersede that of being a human. Because that's exactly against why the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was made. And it came out of a splitting of identities and a hierarchy of identities. So that's where I'm afraid things are moving. But I am actually very optimistic that a lot of the fire, a lot of the anger and the loss that's coming out that people express in the way that you're talking about, Miriam, is because the world is changing. Because we're no longer allowing spaces where abuse, misogyny, race, you know, systemic racism is allowed, and those old systems of power are breaking down, new ones are rising, and that's why we're getting the backlash. So I'm hopeful that things are changing actually for the good, but I think it's really important to be aware of where things look a bit, you know, worrying, threatening.
I mean, I wonder if you went to the Israelites standing at Sinai and said to them, you know, what are human rights? Moses is going to go up this mountain and bring down a rule of law that will pursue justice. What is justice? What is human rights? I wonder what they would have said back in the wilderness, having their experiences that they'd come from and where they felt they were going. You know, even in Torah, we can't even see past the idea that there wouldn't be slaves. We can think about how we might be nice to them, but we can't think beyond a time. So I think human existence is very limited by society as it's structured at that time. So we can only see human rights within the context of where we're at that moment, with some maybe pushing the envelope ever so slightly. But even Torah is not able to really rethink human rights from a perspective. We don't want to be the slaves, but we can't imagine never having society that even has that differentiation between master and slave.
Yeah, although there are moments, aren't there? Like I always talk about the social ethic at the heart of the Torah is like Genesis 1:27. Everyone is made in the image of God. I mean, that is human rights. That's all. Whenever I'm talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and Torah, that is it. That, and you're right. I think we fall from that ideal. I think given the context, we're confused and we fall from that ideal. But I do think you can find it there. And the principles of like being radical and courageous, because the Torah was like the most radical of Near Eastern law codes. So there's something of the principles in it. But, you know, I agree generally.
I think it's how do we get to the core of what this radical text was saying to that time that we can then say, okay, well, that's what. So, for example, there's this awful thing where if you rape a virgin, you have to marry her, which as a modern reader, that's brutal and awful. But within the context of the day was saying you have to take responsibility for your actions and take care of this person whose destiny you have ruined. This is now your responsibility. So the core of it is how do we protect the vulnerable? It's not we should marry virgins who are raped to their rapists, right? We take the core of the meaning rather than the literal, oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and that's the rule of law. That's the consequences. Those are the accountability parts of it, which is how you enable justice. So I think that that's why we're so, in Judaism, we're so concerned by it. Yeah. Rabbiting on.
And that's it from Rabbiting On for this year. Do join us again on January the 4th when we're really thrilled to be recording a special episode of Rabbiting On to mark 80 years of the reform movement in the UK, and are particularly thrilled to welcome a giant of the reform movement in the UK onto the show as we talk to David Jacobs. I would love to hear from our listeners and to understand from them what their concerns are and what they see as the real power behind community and projects, and what we can do to change and to make society fairer and just for all. As always, you can get in touch on media@rjuk.org or tweet us at Reform Movement. Happy New Year to both of you and to all of our listeners.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.